RFI, Radio France International.
It's Wednesday, the 21st of November, and a very good day to you. This is Paris Live. Now, coming up in this, our latest edition of our new programmes today, we'll be taking a look in detail at the visit to France of Emirati Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed amid the polemic surrounding French arms sales to the UAE and Saudi Arabia as the war of attrition in Yemen continues. And we take a look at an RFI English video piece on street art in Paris, directed by Rosie Collier. And our in-studio guest today is renowned Paris-based graffiti artist Darko, and we'll be discussing the current direction of this urban art form and whether it has a future in commercial veins. Now, we also have a special report from Zimbabwe marking exactly a year to the day since former President Robert Mugabe resigned following a coup d'etat. And we'll be getting the latest on what's happening in Brussels today after the EU Commission rejected Italy's 2019 budget, declaring it in breach of EU rules, paving the way for disciplinary measures or sanctions to you and I. We'll be hearing from our correspondent in the EU capital, and we'll have what's trending on RFIEnglish.com with our web editor today, James Mulholland. So for all that and more, stay with us here on Paris Live. Now, first to that top story on Paris Live today. Rights groups are calling on French President Emmanuel Macron to raise concerns over war violations in Yemen with Abu Dhabi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed, who is indeed visiting Paris this Wednesday. MBZ, as he's known, is one of the most influential leaders in the Arab world. And RFI's Amanda Mara joins me in the studio with more on Franco-Emirati relations and how this visit is being seen as an opportunity to pressure both countries. Now, Amanda, ties between France and the UAE, they go back some way, don't they?
They do indeed, David. It's worth noting that Abu Dhabi is actually home to France's only permanent military base in the region, in the Middle East. It's called Al Dhafra, and it's on the shores of the Persian Gulf, less than 250 k's from Iran. The Sorbonne University also has an outpost in the Emirates. And just last month, the UAE actually became an observing member, I think you call it, of La Francophonie. That's, of course, the international organization of French-speaking countries.
They're joining Ireland in that, in
all fairness. They're joining Ireland as well.
They've got observer status.
You don't actually need to have a majority of French speakers in the country.
Indeed.
The last few years, David, have seen the relationship between France and the UAE strengthened with bilateral deals agreed across a range of areas. They include security, trade, also cultural exchanges. You remember that this time last year, November 2017,
you were there.
I was there. I was in Abu Dhabi for the opening of the Louvre Museum there. Macron was there as well to inaugurate that museum, whose sole purpose is to promote cultural exchange between East and West. And as you also said, David, concerning the relationship between the two countries, not least, France is also a major supplier of arms to the country.
Indeed, Amanda, that these arms sales have become a major sticking point with the UAE and, of course, Saudi Arabia.
That's right. Now, eight French NGOs have issued statements this week calling on France to act to stop the war in Yemen. They say that MBZ is a very powerful man and that he bears responsibility for the continuation of the war. They say reports have provided evidence that shows that Saudi-led coalition has indeed committed war crimes and violations of international humanitarian law. One of the NGOs, the International Alliance for the Defense of Rights and Freedoms, is actually suing MBZ, accusing him of war crimes, of complicity in torture and inhumane treatment in Yemen. That's according to his lawyer. So what do these NGOs want? Well, they want for Emmanuel Macron, in a nutshell, to threaten to stop sales of weapons to the UAE if the country doesn't work to ensure those weapons aren't used to commit violations of international law.
Now, indeed, will you remind us of the situation in Yemen and the gravity of that war, which, I mean, I don't like to hyperbolise, but it really does come across as a war of attrition.
It does indeed. It's been going on for 3 years since 2014. The Saudi-led coalition is, of course, fighting the Iran-backed Houthi rebels. Now, the coalition has been accused of indiscriminate strikes that have hit the population hard, bombing homes, markets and schools. A partial blockade by the coalition has left an estimated 22 million people in desperate need of humanitarian aid. The charity Save the Children on Tuesday went further, saying that some 85,000 children, David, under the age of five, may have died from acute malnutrition since that war started.
Indeed, that they are horrible figures. Now, we hear a lot about the Saudis and, of course, the now infamous Mohammed bin Salman. But just how powerful is the UAE's army to the north of Saudi Arabia?
Well, you know, the UAE has really imposed itself as a regional military power. It's implicated in the Libyan conflict as well as in the war in Yemen. MBZ has built a very modern Emirati army that I just read actually employs 6% of the male population in the country. Experts say the army is, in fact, overarmed. I should also point out that MBZ is the Deputy Supreme Commander of the Armed Forces. He's also a graduate of Sandhurst, the Royal Military Academy.
College, yeah.
The UAE Army is nicknamed the Sparta of the Middle East, and that's, of course, in reference to the ancient Greek city, which is known for its formidable
frugality and tough conditions,
well,
basically.
Quite. Now, I should also point out that at age 57, MBZ is still only the crown prince. He's not the emir of the UAE, which, if you didn't already know, that's a federation of seven petrol-rich emirates. He is the de facto ruler with his half-brother, Sheikh Khalifa, sidelined after suffering a stroke in 2014.
So now, is it, however, briefly fair to say that he's more discreet than his neighbour, MBS, of Saudi Arabia?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because we wouldn't want to confuse MBZ
with MBS.
Yeah. MBZ, he's very influential, very well-connected. He cultivates personal relationships with many leaders, including Macron. There are lots of similarities between the two Mohammeds. Unsurprising, because while the UAE may be a smaller player on the world stage, MBZ has in fact acted as a mentor to the younger Saudi Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman. And one expert, finally, David, on Gulf monarchies, actually told RFI that the younger Saudi prince, who of course is in his 30s, has long been fascinated by MBZ, who he considers a visionary.
A visionary indeed. Well, Amanda Morrow, thank you very much for that explanation of the background behind the arrival of MBZ here in Paris today. And of course, you can get that on RFIEnglish.com in even more detail, if you will. My thanks there to Amanda Morrow. Now, staying on the topic of, well, I suppose the Middle East oil, but this is more of a scandal. 14 French companies here today are going on trial for their involvement in a scandal that saw them win contracts in exchange for payments to Iraq under the former leader Saddam Hussein. Now, the companies, which include Renault Trucks, Legrand and Schneider Electric, were acquitted 3 years ago, but the Court of Appeal has already shown it may see things differently. Now, RFI's Mike Woods is with me here in the studio, and you've been looking into this, Mike. Give us some background to this case, first and foremost.
Sure, David. So this has to do with a United Nations program called Oil for Food. Now, that program ran in the late 1990s and early 2000s with the view of helping Iraqi civilians who were suffering under international sanctions. Now, the idea of this was to let the regime of Saddam Hussein sell oil on the world market in exchange for food, medicine, and humanitarian needs. But the scheme was quickly abused, with contracts going to companies who were willing to pay kickbacks, paying some profits that went into the Iraqi state coffers. The UN concluded in 2005 that more than 2,000 companies, including 180 here in France, were involved, in more than 1.5 billion euros worth of corrupt payments.
Well, it seems like it's one of those stories of, like, if everybody's at it, we can't lose out. But what exactly is at stake in today's trial?
Well, the 14 companies in court today do not deny having taken part in this program. Some say that they took part in all transparency and with knowledge of French officials. They were acquitted of wrongdoing in 2015 on the grounds that the facts did not match the corruption offense that they were being charged with, namely that Iraqi officials that they dealt with were not actually pocketing money as individuals, but were acting on behalf of the state. But Juliette Lullier, a law professor at the University of Strasbourg who studied this case, says that there's still solid grounds for a different result this time around.
The French companies prosecuted at the moment, they knew that this 10% was illegal money, and they paid that despite the UN resolution. The deal was they would pay more for the first barrels in order to have the opportunity, the illegal opportunity to get more barrels. And the second point is the argument of the defense saying that the Iraqi officials who gathered the money, they did not act against the interest of Iraq. Usually in corruption, the corrupted person takes money for himself and doesn't give the money to the state. So this case is quite special in this sense. But you have two crimes. You have active corruption and you have passive corruption. And I think it is right to say that there is active corruption if the companies knew that the money was not legal, even if the Iraqi agents were not corrupted in the sense of the law.
Now, since that first decision 3 years ago, the same appeals court, as where the trial is happening today, convicted another set of companies, including the oil giant Total, of bribery offenses in regards to the Oil for Food program. So there is that legal precedent, which makes a guilty verdict against these 14 companies all the more possible. So this trial opens this afternoon, and it's slated to run until the end of next week.
And we'll be keeping an eye out to see what that appeals court has to say. My thanks there to RFI's Mike Woods. You're listening to Paris Live.
The Trois Continents Film Festival is 40 years young. From Asia, this year's special guest country is Taiwan, home of Hao Shouxian and Tsai Minglian. From Africa, from Mozambique, Picture Frame, a film featured in South Africa's Durban Film Festival market. From Latin America, Cristina Gallego and Chiro Guerra's Birds of Passage opens the festival this year with age-old traditions challenged by lucrative drug trafficking. Those are some of the few film adventures this year at Nantes. Jury members Mohamed Salih Haroun from Chad, Shlomi Elkabats from Israel and Anurag Kashyap from India, with Noemi Lvovsky and Lucy Borloteau from France, will pick the winners of the Gold and Silver Balloon Awards on the 27th of November. Join me, Roslyn Hyams, for RFI at the 40th Trois Continents Film Festival, opening on November the 20th in Nantes.
And Roslyn will be joining us live from Nantes in a little over a half an hour for, well, what actually happened at that opening ceremony at the Trois Continents Film Festival. You're listening to Paris Live here on Radio France International's English service. And, of course, you can tweet at RFI English. Send us a message. It's live now. And you can, of course, write to us on parislive@rfi.fr. Now, this is our big chunk of the day. This is all about street art. And this weekend, a street artist will be awarded the biennial Prix du Graffiti here in Paris. Now, the winner will be selected from among 30 or so graffiti artists whose works are currently on display at the Pavillon de l'Eau Gallery, not too far from here in Paris's affluent 16th arrondissement, and all of the artworks will go under the hammer this coming Sunday, and five-figure bids are certain, and some may be bought for over 100,000 euros. Now, for more on how graffiti has gone from being perceived as the work of vandals to becoming a sought-after commodity, I'm joined in the studio today by the acclaimed Paris-based street artist Darko. You're very welcome back to the programme.
Nice to have me here.
It is great to see you again. And first, I would like to turn to my colleague, Rosie Collier, who is with us in the studio for this roundtable. And Rosie, you've been doing some reporting on street art in Paris and on the Prix du Graffiti. So let's start from the beginning. First, over to Rosie to get a bit of background to why we're here today. When and how did graffiti first make its mark in France, Rosie?
Well, graffiti started appearing on railways and streets in the less salubrious suburbs around Marseille in the south and here in Paris in the 1980s. Young men, mainly from immigrant backgrounds, who were influenced by US hip-hop, took to tagging. And like their counterparts in the US, they tagged to mark their territory. Sometimes it was gang-related and sometimes not. Some of these guys clashed with police who considered them vandals. The places they were tagging, though, were often government-owned property, be it railway infrastructure or public housing. That's still the case today. I mean, just think about your commute to work, David and Darko.
Indeed.
I mean, is unimaginable without graffiti, right?
Sure.
Mm. And graffiti is done without permission, for the most part. It consists mainly of tagging. But there are some guys and women with a lot of artistic talent.
And of course, present company not accepted here. This is Darko, one of the best graffiti artists that the country is paying host to. But back to Rosie, you mentioned talent. What is it that differentiates, should I say, graffiti from street art, from what you've learnt?
Well, what happened is that some graffiti artists began organising themselves into collectives. This would be, I guess, late 90s, early 2000s. And for them, it became about creating pieces of art that were to be enjoyed by the public as opposed to just tagging. Mm. And a good example of this is the Galerie Itinérance in the 13th District of Paris. It's a collective of over 100 street artists today. They have a gallery space that's tucked away behind the François Mitterrand Library. But the works that impact most and are done by the collective are those huge frescoes painted on the sides of high-rise buildings in the 13th District. And what's interesting is that in 2004, the collective got permission from the then mayor of the 13th District, to paint murals on public buildings. And crucially, they negotiated a contract whereby the collective gets to touch up existing murals and paint new ones. So this is street art as opposed to graffiti, although I imagine some collective members still consider themselves graffiti artists. I imagine Darko has some interesting things to say about the differences and similarities between graffiti and street artists.
Yes, there are lots of different graffiti forms. It can be stencils, it can be tagging or graffiti writing, drawing letters and stuff. But it can also be all other kinds of things, such as graphic design, illustrations.
Of which there's a lot now coming much more to the fore. Like we have a colleague here, Claire Broadhurst, who actually has a little Instagram photo kind of gallery, if you will, of all of these little small kind of Banksy-esque artworks that are popping up all over around Paris. So it's really become a thing now, hasn't it?
It's graffiti and street art is a big, big global culture, and it has been since almost 50 years now. And there's not a lot of cultures of art cultures that are that old.
Now, how would you? We never like to pigeonhole people, but do you consider yourself a street artist, a graffiti artist, or a graffiti writer?
I consider myself as an artist, but I'm coming from the graffiti writing background. So basically, I'm concentrating myself on the lettering, and I try to transform them and to build them up and make them into new images, which are not necessarily figurative. So it's kind of an abstract painting, and then I put some. Characters, for example, to the side just to illustrate them, and I started doing big murals at in the 80s, even the late 80s, and I always wanted, like, for me it was always an art, and I make no difference whether a painting has been done with an illegal background or legal background.
So you were drawn to it initially just because of the power of the art itself, but then there was the foundation of that FBI, Darko FBI, back in the 80s.
Yeah.
Tell us a little about how does one go about founding a kind of a graffiti street art foundation, especially going back as far as the mid-1980s. You know, we're going back over 30 years now.
Yeah, basically I just had some friends who were interested in the same culture, and we tried to hook up and to paint murals, and it's difficult to have the paint that's necessary to paint a big mural. So we all came together and put our paint together and painted big murals all together. And then we just first did whatever we could, and then we tried to planify it a bit more and made frescoes, basically.
So that is really, one could say, the birthplace of the kind of ideal of a collective, if you will, when it comes to like an art collective.
I'm not sure if that's the basics, but
maybe it was still a group effort.
It was a group effort, but maybe in the caves it was as well.
Sure, in Lasso or wherever it might be. But now you mentioned there about the culture of graffiti. Now, when Rosie alluded to this about, you know, coming up from steeped in hip-hop, how does music affect graffiti and or street art styles? I mean, New York was very influenced by hip-hop. Detroit was very influenced by electro. What influence, let's say, do we have in Paris or Marseille or maybe Versailles, where Air, the group, came from? Does it have a difference? Is there a different musical kind of background to the crew, if you will, that work in various cities in France?
Well, as there are very different ideas of graffiti, for example, stencils is graffiti, but it's totally different. And there's like rock alternative kind of graffiti, then there's political graffiti, then there is graffiti writing, and also graphic design or illustration or pop art, and all this comes together in under the name of street art, and sometimes it doesn't have anything to do with one another. Mm-hmm. But in my case, it was the hip-hop influence from New York. They mm-hmm. hopped over into to Europe, and I first started to listening to the music and started to break dance and stuff like that. And I was drawing since I was a little kid, so the imagery kind of spoke to me.
Spoke
and the first time I actually saw it consciously was in the movie called The Warriors. And I saw that movie in the theaters, and I sort of liked the character that was just drawing instead of fighting. And so I just started to look at it and maybe to draw it in my little drawings I did on paper. And after a while, I just started to go in the streets because I wanted to show what I was doing. And I always tried to do the best I could. I didn't start tagging, actually.
Yeah.
I started drawing things and just to show it to people. There was no other solution as to go into the streets.
Well, that's a great history. Now, let's just say we can fast forward right up until this year. We saw last month the British, graffiti artist, street artist, I suppose street artist or graphic street artist, Banksy, who shocked the world when a member of his entourage actually activated a shredder. I mean, it was something that went viral and everybody was just like, oh my God, what has happened with this art being shredded out of its frame? But it still went on to gather millions at auction. What do you feel, or what are your feelings about, especially now what we were talking about with Rosie today, about street art becoming a commodity in modern time?
Well, that's a good thing because we're all artists and we all have to make a living. So it's a good thing that it can be done in different ways. It can be in the art market. It can be in other markets as a designer, for example, or architect or whatever. And I think graffiti and graffiti writing is an excellent school for a lot of people, and so that they can move on and have a project in life. And so it's a good thing that people can actually live off their passion.
Indeed, it's something that they can actually aspire to actually make a living out of, I suppose. That's a positive side indeed. And back to you, Rosie, our director, our in-house director, we can say. You just produced a video report about this Prix du Graffiti. Now, tell us about the video.
Well, It's a profile of this man, Cedric Naimi, who's playing in the background. But for those who can't see, I filmed him on a couple of occasions earlier this month. Our first rendezvous was in the Pavillon de l'Eau that you mentioned earlier, where the artworks are currently on display and will be until Sunday. He explained to begin with that graffiti artists were sceptical about the prize, actually, and that selecting a jury was also complicated. But he persisted, and since its debut in 2013, the Prix de Graffiti has now apparently gained the respect of most graffiti artists. On the one hand, the Prix de Graffiti is about recognising talent, that's for sure. This year, the theme is water. Graffiti artists were invited to paint frescoes with water as the main theme. And there are some stunning pieces of work on display there at the gallery. But on the other hand, the Prix de Graffiti and the associated exhibition is about business. Although Cedric refused to be drawn in on the issue of money, I did pose those questions to him.
He wasn't short a few quid anyway, do you think?
I don't think so. But, you know, the fact that all the artworks will be auctioned on Sunday shows that business is one of the motivating factors for artists and organisers. But just, you know, as Darko just said, good for them. It's a way to make a living out of their passion. I mean, I'll be at the prize giving ceremony on Saturday, so I can report back to you on Monday
about
who won and how much was paid for the highest selling piece of work. But until then, you can go to our website, and that's www.en.rfi.fr to watch the video about the Prix de Graffiti and to read more about art, street art here in Paris.
And indeed, apart from that complicated link, that is also linked to RFIEnglish.com. Darko, the final word over to you. Have you ever met Monsieur, is it André? Is that his name? Cyril?
Cedric.
Have you ever met this gentleman?
Yes, I did.
And what do you make of him, and what do you think of this prize? Do you think it is something worthwhile?
It's a good thing. It's a good project to actually officializing a bit more, because there's still a lot to be done, that needs to be done concerning graffiti and graffiti writing and street art and etc. There's a lot to be done that needs to be done, and we just started right now,
and it's getting underway. Okay, well, look, I have to say to both of you, Rosie Collier from Radio France International's In the Service, my thank you for coming into the studio today.
Thank you, David.
And Darko, thanks again for coming
in. Thank you very much.
And giving us the opportunity to really delve into the history and the passion that is behind street art. My thanks to both of you. You're listening to Paris Live. So now we are going to move on, and this is our little reportage that we're coming in from Zimbabwe today, and it's exactly a year to the day since a coup led to the resignation of former leader Robert Mugabe in the country. Now, his resignation this day last year was received with wild celebrations, and many Zimbabweans entertained hopes change was on its way. A year later, Zimbabweans, however, feel cheated and nothing has changed, and are debating if the country could be suffering as the coup was executed in November, which is, to some, a sacred month. More from John Kasim in Harare, Zimbabwe.
November is supposed a sacred month in some cultures in Zimbabwe. Bride price scraped and other cultural traditions are not allowed to take place. Tradition was disrupted in November 2017 following a coup. This led to the installation of President Emmerson Mnangagwa after the resignation of Robert Mugabe. Nano Jinarin Mugabe had been leader of the country since independence in 1980 and was accused of plunging the country into economic turmoil. His downfall was received with wild celebrations and hope for change. Was the coup executed in the wrong month? Was it taboo to install Mnangagwa as the new leader in a sacred month? Exactly a year later, the country is still in a crisis, leaving many Zimbabweans feeling that politicians violated the traditional space. For more on this, I visited the professor, Claude Mararike, at his Harare home.
There are certain obligations for the living to the dead. And there are also certain obligations to the dead, to the gods. And the gods need time to rest. The ancestors also need time to rest. The living, you and me, also need time to rest. That's where the month of November, which I'm explaining, begins. That's the general belief among the Shona people. Now, the month of November in mythology, Shona mythology, was designated for that kind of rest by the gods and the upper spirits. They want to rest. Now, what things must they rest from your requests?
Patisa Nyati, a historian based in Bulawayo, the second largest city, says that November is also sacred to the Ndebele people. I spoke to him by telephone from Harare.
You will never understand Africa if you don't go via African beliefs, African cosmology, African thought, African philosophy. Africans recognize that in nature has times of rest and times of work. Right now is the beginning of the time of work by nature. I'm not talking about human beings, but nature.
Professor Mararike says the 2017 November coup was frowned upon by traditional elders.
You can vary the practice, but the fundamental must remain. The fundamental is that you don't do certain central things in November. Marriage is one such central principle. Kuroa Gua is yet another central principle. And those fundamentals must not be done in November. Even the practice of installing chiefs and kings in November, people would say, I had grumbles even here when the president was installed in November. The elders grumbled and said, Makanganis. They were grumbling to say, this should not have been done. You can suppress them. It's like changing our blackness, our Africanness. You can't change that. The moment you change even the languages, you are changing the fundamental.
George Mujuru is a spirit medium based in Epworth, Harare. He echoed sentiments similar to Professor Mararike and Nyati. Mujuru claimed the spirit spoke to him in a vision where he was told how Mugabe was going to fall. He refused to associate the 2017 November events to the myth around the sacred month.
No, the challenges were already there. Yes, regardless of the fact that it was November. That particular execution was in November. Robert Mugabe sat in his office. That's what the spirits are giving me in a vision, sitting in his office, busy counting over my papers, my elections. Little did Robert Mugabe know, the spirit had already said it. So what could this mean? I had to keep quiet. It's a different issue from a November month.
Reporting for RFI, this is John Kasim in Harare, Zimbabwe.
And there you heard it from John Kasim from Harare in Zimbabwe, marking that 1 year since the resignation of President Robert Mugabe. We're going to have a little musical break, and seeing that we're having a bit of a hip-hop theme today, here are the Beastie Boys. We'll be right back. You're listening to Paris Live, and that, of course, was the inimitable Beastie Boys with Jimmy James from the album Check Your Head, which, if you can believe it, is 26 years old this year. Now, moving on, Amnesty International today starts its Decoding Raqqa project. Now, the project aims at mapping out the destruction of this Syrian city as a result of a four-month shelling campaign by US-led coalition forces that cost the lives of hundreds, if not thousands, of people. Now, joining me now in the studio is RFI's Jan van der Maden. Now, Jan, this is not just a report in the making along the lines we're used to from this organization, but it is a collective effort where volunteers have played a large part.
Yeah, it's a kind of crowdfunding effort with this decoding format Amnesty in cooperation with a London-based Air Wars Org organization. Amnesty drafts 50,000 volunteers in over 150 countries. They already did projects on Darfur and oil spills, and I asked veteran Amnesty researcher Donatella Rovira, who is directly involved in this Raqqa project, to tell us a bit more about it.
The reason why we are doing this part of the project in this way, by using volunteers, it's because it's a huge task, and it is something that it is possible and interesting to do for ordinary people. They can do it from their home as long as they have a mobile phone or a laptop or some sort of mobile device to track through satellite imagery on different days throughout the old military operation, which lasted 4 months and a week, and to identify the precise moment when different buildings, and there were more than 11,000 buildings, were destroyed.
Now, Jan, if when we think about the destroyed cities in Syria, we think of the town of Aleppo, and that really comes to mind first, which was actually Syria's largest city, with it, the harrowing pictures of completely devastating buildings and ruins.
Yeah, Raqqa's destruction has gone relatively underreported, and Günther Meyer, director of the Center for Research of the Arab World at the University of Mainz, says that this is all part of a propaganda war. He says basically the Syrian regime and the Russians are seen as the bad guys, and they destroyed Aleppo, and the Americans and their allies are the proverbial good guys who kicked the Islamic State out of Raqqa, which was their capital.
U.S. Army said there were just 23 civilian victims as a result of this massive destruction. Reports start with at least 1,400 civilians who were killed, go up to more than 6,000 people. Many of them, this appears also in the report of Amnesty International, the American soldiers were interviewed, and they said, well, for us, everybody who was within Raqqa was regarded to be a fighter of ISIS. And people, families who try to escape in particular via the Euphrates River, they were just shot, they were killed, they were bombed.
Raqqa is the most destroyed city in modern time. Certainly much more destroyed than Aleppo in percentage terms, because the part of Aleppo that was destroyed was the part of Aleppo that was bombed repeatedly by Syrian regime and by Russian forces. That was the part of the city, about half of the city, which was under control of the opposition. In the case of Raqqa, it's not part of the city. It's the entire city.
That was Donatella Rovira again, and with the Decoding Raqqa report, she says Amnesty is basically doing the work, the coalition forces, which she says should investigate why there was this level of destruction of the civilian population who did not have any part in that war.
And we will be following how that Decoding of Raqqa project develops. And my thanks there to RFI's Jan van der Maden. You're listening to Paris Live here on RFI English. Now, the European Commission today started procedures against Italy for violating the EU's budget rules after the new populist government in Rome drafted a budget for 2019 with a 2.4% deficit. Now, Italy will have until midway through next year to take action to get its deficit under control. But the government in Rome is relishing this fight and seems unlikely to back down. Now, our Brussels correspondent Dave Keating joins us on the line from the EU capital. Now, Dave, what exactly has the Commission decided today?
Well, essentially, this has started a process. The big question today was whether the European Commission would find Italy in non-compliance with its budgetary commitments. The Commission had to make a review of all member states in the so-called 126 reports in which it assesses who's complying and who's not complying. And the hesitation here on the Commission's part was they are not trying to provoke a conflict with Italy, because the fear is that this actually benefits the government, the populist government in Italy. They want to set up a showdown between Rome and Brussels, and so this plays right into their hands. But the Commission had to assess whether Italy's draft budget conformed to the rules. That's its job. And as they said today, they had to find that the budget does not comport to the rules. And so essentially, this now goes to more procedures. Member states of the European Union, the national capitals, have 2 weeks whether to decide whether or not to accept the Commission's finding or not. If they do accept it, then we start the excessive deficit procedure in which Italy could eventually face fines.
And indeed, the 100 million thousand lira question is, how is the Italian government responding?
Well, predictably, they are not happy and also defiant. They've said today that the 2.4% budget deficit figure will not be adjusted. That's an absolute non-starter. They won't touch it. They need it in order to fulfill their campaign promises, which included a number of spending-heavy measures like a universal basic income. Now, they have said that they would be willing to make some adjustments around the edges, but that is really all they're willing to do, and those would be minor changes, they say. They also need to save political face here. A lot of why they were elected, the Five Star Movement and the Northern League, the way they drew a lot of their support in the campaign was by states projecting themselves as standing up to Brussels, and particularly against Brussels' austerity regime. So they politically really can't give in to this. And the Commission knows that. So both sides are in kind of a not a good place to make an agreement right now.
And indeed, the gauntlet has been thrown down, and we're, I suppose, waiting disciplinary measures. But that, of course, just means sanctions to me and you. But what exactly happens next?
Well, the next thing we're going to be watching is the Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte is coming to have a dinner with Jean-Claude Juncker on Saturday night. That was actually a pre-planned dinner, but the two leaders are there going to see if they can hammer out some kind of agreement, maybe come to some kind of understanding. But essentially, after that, the ball is in the court of member states, who will decide whether or not to accept this. If they do, the procedure actually probably won't start until January, and then Italy has 6 months to take action to respond. And so that basically puts us to July. If they don't take action by then they'll be facing fines. But of course, this is all over the 2019 budget. So we're really looking at a situation where Italy won't face fines until we're a year into the year that this budget concerns, which is kind of a weird situation. The issue could be moot by then. So I wouldn't expect Italy to give in here, given that because of the time frame, time is kind of on their side rather than on Brussels' side.
They have got a margin to maneuver. Okay, we'll leave it at that. My thanks there to our Brussels correspondent, Dave Keating. You're listening to Paris Live here on Radio France International. Now, President Emmanuel Macron told the French government today to take a tough line on the need for the Gilets Jaunes movement to respect the law. He has said that little so far in public about the Gilets Jaunes, since around 300,000 people in fluorescent vests succeeded in bringing much of France to a standstill on Saturday by blocking roads in protest at a hike in petrol prices. Now, Macron and his government are struggling to deal with the movement. It has no leader and the Gilets communicate via social media. In many parts of France, roads are still blocked. Riot police moved in to dislodge protesters who had blocked access to an oil refinery on Tuesday. And RFI's Angela Diffley joins me now in the studio. So, Angela, just give us an update into exactly what's happening now with this Gilets Jaunes movement.
Well, there is a lull at the moment. Some of the roadblocks have continued, but that's it's winding down ahead of a build-up on Saturday. We'll talk about that in a moment. Basically, the government appears to be trying a two-pronged approach. Emmanuel Macron yesterday talked about dialogue. He seems to be trying to give the impression that the government is ready to listen, but remaining firm on those policies of taxes on petrol. They will not back down on that. And the Gilets Jaunes aren't interested in kind words. They want what they consider punitive taxes to end. The other prong, the government is intent on securing, as you just said, he mentioned to the cabinet today, law and order must be respected. There must be no racist or xenophobic or homophobic chants during any demonstrations, and the public security must be guaranteed. That will be easier said than done.
Well, indeed, there is no leader of the Gilets Jaunes, so these could be just little elements that can come out of the woodwork of just personal opinion for anybody who is protesting. But you did mention something there about coming up this Saturday. Now, we're only the middle of the week now, but what is planned for next weekend?
We don't know. That's the point. Because it is a leaderless movement, there is a plan that they will come to Paris on Saturday. Now, the government has let it be known that it will tolerate some sort of peaceful gathering. It has suggested perhaps the Place de la République or Bastille, both well-known venues for protests. They are not the venues which the Gilets Jaunes had in mind. They want the Place de la Concorde, which would be a security nightmare for the government.
And it's also a traffic crossroads and a hub. I mean, it would shut down the whole city, basically.
Absolutely. The fear is that the government will not be able to, the police will not be able to ensure the security of the members of the public or indeed the Gilets Jaunes. Nobody knows where they are planning to go, how many of them will turn up and what they plan to do. So it's a security nightmare.
So this must really appeal to the younger members of the population as well, because this is truly anarchy in France. There's no leader and they are really all getting behind themselves to actually make their point.
There's a lot of genuine worry behind this, though, from the government. There's a genuine worry. And looking, when you see at these roadblocks, most of them are middle-aged. They're not youngsters. Many of them have jobs. They use their cars to get to work. It's not a ragtag bunch of youngsters. This is a very angry group of people, mostly, as we said on Monday, people from small towns, villages, the suburbs of small towns and rural France, and they are angry.
They are angry, and the divide is definitely showing there. Okay, Angela Diffley, thank you very much for that update on that Gilets Jaunes protest movement that is sweeping France. You're listening to Paris Live here on RFI. It is great to have you on the programme, Angela. And of course, to our listeners, you can send us a tweet at RFI English. And of course, you can write to us at parislive@rfi.fr. Oh, and if that doesn't give you goosebumps and tickles up your spine, if you are, of course, a true French person. But I am joined in the studio too, the second best to a true Frenchman, and that is Paul Myers, who is joining me now in the studio. Now, France played their 18th and final match of 2018 last night at the Stade de France here just outside of Paris, and it was a friendly against Uruguay, and it finished 1-0 to Les Bleus. Olivier Giroud got the only goal of the game from the penalty spot early in the second half. Now, Paul, you are indeed with us here, and you were at that match last night, but in your words, it wasn't spectacular.
No, it wasn't. It was quite stodgy, and it really didn't produce the pyrotechnics that one might have expected. France had Kylian Mbappe and Antoine Griezmann among seven of the players who were in the starting 11 for the World Cup final against Croatia in July. Uruguay, they were fielding Barcelona's Luis Suarez and Paris Saint-Germain's Edinson Cavani. Nothing really happened. You know, Mbappe went off with a shoulder injury just before halftime. No goals. A hard-fought win. But afterwards, the French players all spoke about the next challenge. And here's midfielder Blaise Matuidi.
It was very important to finish the year with a win. It was a really wonderful year winning the World Cup in Russia. That will be with us forever. But 2018 is over and now we have to look ahead. There are new challenges such as the qualifiers for Euro 2020. But first up, we've got 4 months back with our clubs for a lot of important games. That's what we have to think about for the moment. And then we'll get back together in March for the Euro qualifiers. Hopefully, it will be with the same desire that we had in 2018 so that we can qualify for the next big tournament.
Well, that's Blaise Matuidi there. And the question is, how will the France coach Didier Deschamps maintain the motivation? Is it simply a question of bringing in new faces? For example, last night, Ferland Mendy and his Lyon teammate Tanguy Ndombele made their debuts. And they were very impressive. Antoine Grenier, my colleague from RFI's sports service, has been following France's season. He told me that Mendy and Ndombele could be the men to freshen up the squad.
You'll have to acknowledge that some of his world champions have to be replaced. There's some of them that can't be in the French team anymore. When you listen to what Deschamps says about Ndombele, he says that he can be the guy who can replace Paul Pogba. And Deschamps is not the kind of guy who says that kind of things. Right. So Ndombele showed something very interesting during the game against Uruguay, but he showed also something interesting when he played against Iceland. And Ferland Mendy has his right and his left foot, and it's quite a huge quality that not so much French player have in the defense. So there's a new generation that Deschamps will have to bring in that team, like he did with Mbappé. He can do that. He has the charisma to make these players confident, and I think we'll see that new players and almost a new face of this French team. Deschamps is smart enough to find a way.
So he'll have somebody to look for in 2019. He has his homework for 2019.
He's got a lot of homework, and we want to see some new players, like there's Abdou Diallo, there's young players in France, Abdou Diallo, Dayot Upamecano. We saw Alassane Plea recently against Uruguay, but he played just 10 minutes. There's a lot of players that Didier Deschamps didn't call or didn't use, but that can be the future of this team.
So there's room for improvement, even for World Cup winners.
Well, the best answer to that is the one that Kylian Mbappé did. We asked him, what can you wish? And he says, the European Championship, and I want to win other titles. So yes, there's room for improvement, and that's a good news.
And that was Antoine Grenier of RFI Sports Service. So, David, you know, while Deschamps plots his fortunes and France's for 2019, Ireland have dispensed with the services of Martin O'Neill. That's some more football news.
So pretty.
Yeah, he leaves after a poor run of results that led to the relegation of Ireland in the UEFA Nations League. O'Neill was in charge for 55 games over 5 years and famously took Ireland to the last 16 at the Euro 2016 here in France. Lots of singing and dancing then, but it's all over for Martin O'Neill.
I think the statistics are terrible. Something like 2 goals in 18 months. I don't know. I think maybe I'm exaggerating, but the other thing as well that the polemic in Ireland is that the Irish football managers are incredibly well paid. for a small island country. And I mean, there was a lackluster performance against Northern Ireland last week, and then there was Denmark the other day. So, I mean, I think it was time to go. The writing was on the wall.
No World Cups then.
Exactly, in big green paint. Okay, my thanks there to Paul Myers for that look at, that French game and the future for France and the demise of O'Neill there in Ireland. My thanks to Paul Myers. Now, in Western France, in Nantes, the Trois Continents, Three Continents Film Festival, got underway last night, and RFI's Rosalind Hyams was there and joins me on the line from Nantes now. Rosalind, great to have you on the programme today. First and foremost, tell us about the opening ceremony.
Well, the opening ceremony took place in the most beautiful Théâtre Gralin, which is also where the opera and musical performances are shown in Nantes, in the city in western France. And it was quite political with on stage, first of all, seven women, in fact. Well, there's been all this talk of inequality, well, not talk, but the reality of the inequality in the cinema industry worldwide. So there were seven women on stage. Five of them were politicians who are all involved in culture and promoting cinema. But they were also political in the sense that they drew out the value of the Three Continents Film Festival, where there are films from Asia, Africa, and Latin America, to raise the subject about migrants, about borders, and about remaining open and being open to others as well, and that the richness is what you should see first in people who come from elsewhere, not the problems that they could possibly cause you. So there was this political overtone. Also, Jérôme Baron, the main artistic director of the Three Continents Film Festival, talked at length about how cinema has changed because of the digital era, and how this is something that they're trying to take into account this year by looking back and looking forward at the same time.
Now, Rosalind, what can we expect over the coming days at the Trois Continents Festival?
Well, we have already started the international film competition. There are nine films who are vying for the gold and silver hot air balloon trophies, because this is also the city of Jules Verne, the 19th century writer who went around the world in 80 days. I think our listeners may know, at least some of them may know about Jules Verne. And there are films then from, we've already seen one film or two films now in competition. One was from Brazil called Temporada, which is by André Novais Oliveira. And his film is about a woman, Juliana, who's a migrant worker. So you see these themes keep coming back. And I've just come out of another film, this one from Thailand, which is very interesting, more experimental. This film is it's a first feature film, but it's been 11 years in the making. And it was actually one of the films that had been selected by the Three Continents workshop section, which is called Produire au Sud, produce in the South. But that was in 2011, some 7 or 8 years ago. So it's also a film that shows how very laborious the process can be made, and particularly for art films. As I said, this one is a first-time film, and by a director who previously had been more of a camera person, a director of photography, Puttifong Arunphen Mantarei. There are political overtones in the film. There's very little dialogue, but there's the suggestion of questions about borders between Thailand, Myanmar, that sort of area of Southeast Asia where there's war, there's conflict, there's persecution, and how people deal with it and how they receive their neighbours as well who are in difficulty.
Okay, Rosalind, thanks for joining us on the line there from the Western French city of Nantes, live from the Three Continents Film Festival. And of course, you'll be able to read more about that festival, as Rosalind will be sending lots of image, content and features regarding the films and the topics being shown at the Three Continents in Nantes, and you can get them all on rfienglish.com.
Now, today on RFI English, we're following various subjects, and I'm joined by our web editor today. That is indeed James Mulholland. So we have got three main things that are kind of moving and shaking. We have, of course, the Abu Dhabi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed's visit, who's here in Paris. That Amanda Morrow was giving us a real breakdown on that. There's an ongoing story about this boost for tuition fees for international students that we have been covering over the last few days. But let's have a look at a more international story that is really kind of hooking on the website today. And that is, of course, the announcement this morning by Interpol of its new president, Kim Jong-yang of South Korea. So tell us a bit about that.
Hi, Dave. Indeed, Interpol, of course, announcing Kim Jong-yang.
Which is based in Lyon, of course. The headquarters is here in Lyon.
Correct. And the new president is now going to be until the year 2020, Kim Jong-yang. And the main rival who was facing off against Kim was the Russian official Alexander Prokopchuk, whose candidacy was obviously very unpopular with many Western nations. He was Kim was Interpol's acting president, as we just said, and he's taken over after the disappearance of the former head, Meng Hongwei, who disappeared in China in September. Still not really many concrete details on what exactly has happened.
It's a very curious case. We have been trying to follow that. I mean, the French police we mentioned the other day have actually dropped the investigation into that, so it is very curious. So, of course, there is Russia's reaction to all of this.
Well, of course, key to the candidacy, of course, in light of the Russian reaction, was the backing of the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. A group of U.S. United States senators, rather, saying that the choice of Russia's Prokopchuk was like putting a fox in charge of a hen house. There was much criticism of Russia's candidate, bringing to mind Moscow's previous applications for Interpol red notices, essentially international arrest warrants to target those who have fallen foul of the Kremlin. Lots of criticism also from the many times jailed opposition leader Alexei Navalny.
Okay, James, we'll leave it at that. We have many more subjects that are being covered on RFIEnglish.com, so you can all access them now. Indeed, another little bit of the Beastie Boys to bring you up to the end of our program here on Paris Live today. And my great thanks to our guest Darko for coming in and talking to us all about the history of street art in France and around the globe. And of course, Rosie Collier's video that is online on RFIEnglish.com.